The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Serra. On Tuesday, July 29th at 11 a.m., the Climate Action Advisory Board Workgroup Utility Decarbonization will be meeting virtually at 11 a.m. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the meeting. Also on Tuesday, July 29th, but at 4 p.m., the Economic Development Coalition meeting will be virtual and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. For details on how to join the meeting virtually, see CorvallisOregon.gov. And finally, on Saturday, August 3rd, Ward 5 Councilor Sharlyn Ellis will hold Government Comment Corner in the lobby of the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. You can stop by to say hello and ask your questions about your local government. Located at the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library here in Corvallis, 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Serra.
This is Explorin' Lauren, bringing you a local nature report. As the beating sun bakes the valley floor, opening cracks in the ancient clays and silts that the rivers left behind in their endless meandering, I found myself retreating to the eastern foothills of the Willamette Valley in search of cool waters and seclusion. Nestled in the hills near the town of Sweet Home, McDowell Creek County Park hosts a small tectonic fault system, which has resulted in a family of waterfalls, which cascade down through the 20-million-year-old sandstone bedrock towards the Saniam River. As I climbed through the shaded undergrowth, I was drawn to the constant misty breeze that is pushed away from the cliffs by the falls. In a lush, shady hollow carved out by water, deer ferns thrive on vertical rock walls that overlook the steep, verdant ravine. It's probably 10 to 15 degrees cooler here than even the forest floor only 50 feet away, a perfect oasis for those of a more amphibious nature. As I scramble along the boulders towards the cascade, a flash of reddish orange and cream soars across my vision to my right, flailing through the air and landing on another rock nearby. There she is, a northern red-legged frog, keeping a safe distance from this large intruder. Within seconds, she is out of sight, scooting her way into a dark, mossy crevice. The northern red-legged frog, or Rana aurora in taxonomy, rarely if ever strays far from water, and these creatures can be found along wetlands and streams from coastal British Columbia to Northern California. Outside of the breeding season, adults spend most of their time in moist sedges, brush, or logs along woodland streams or shady pond edges. They are the largest native frog species found in the state of Oregon, with females reaching up to 4 inches long. And they're listed as an Oregon Conservation Strategy species by the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Those are species of greatest conservation need, whose study helps to focus efforts to restore and maintain habitats. Their long, powerful legs make them excellent at leaping long distances away from predators, as I just witnessed. Predators include snakes, birds, small mammals, and fish. Their long, sticky tongues are well adapted to catching mostly invertebrates as their prey, including insects, small snails, tadpoles and small fish, and even small frogs of other species. Like all frogs, their skin is an important and innate immune system organ, a first line of defense against pathogens in their environment. As Varga et al. Describe in their 2019 article on the topic, the mucus on frog skin comprises a chemical barrier which contains an antimicrobial peptide arsenal. They also have pattern recognition receptors which detect pathogens, plus commensal microbes that help with defense. In the young tadpole stage of their life, northern red-legged frogs are fully aquatic and feed on algae. In the late winter, as soon as temperatures reach about 45 degrees, they will gather in still waters to breed for about 1 to 2 weeks, each female laying about 2,000 eggs, which are attached to submerged plant stems. Males have a low-pitched, underwater mating call consisting of 5 to 7 notes. It sounds like this. After the eggs hatch, tadpoles undergo a complete metamorphosis within about 16 weeks, developing legs and lungs and reabsorbing their tail. Individuals can live to be over 10 years old. The breeding season can be a perilous time for northern red-legged frogs that live near human settlements as they cross busy roads to reach their breeding ponds. So watch out for these horny frogs crossing the roads during the late winter, especially after it rains. At least now we know why the frog crossed the road. Like many native amphibians, their historical range has contracted from habitat destruction and fragmentation. This is due to several factors, which include human development, logging, changing fire regimes, climate change, and predation from invasive species like the American bullfrog and non-native fish. After my brief encounter, I never did see this slippery specimen again that day. But I take comfort in knowing they're safe and cool during the scorching summer heat, nestled somewhere green and moist in the hills. As ecological stewards to the Willamette Valley bioregion, humans still have much work to do in protecting and maintaining biodiversity here, so that creatures like the northern red-legged frog thrive alongside us. More critical habitats like wetlands, prairies, and forests must be protected, restored, and connected as the 21st century progresses. More education and access to experiential learning in wild areas could foster an appreciation for the unbuilt environment, turning local residents into lifelong conservationists. If you own or manage property with streams or wetlands, you can help frogs and toads by leaving coarse, woody debris on the ground, encouraging native plant growth, and avoiding the use of pesticides and herbicides that could contaminate their habitats with runoff. For more data and information about northern red-legged frogs and all 12 of Oregon's native frogs and toads, you can visit myodfw.com. You can also review the Oregon Conservation Strategy at OregonConservationStrategy.org. This has been a KORC Nature Report.
This is Marge Pop for Community Voices on KORC. Today I will read a next door post written by Mark Yeager. In this post, entitled Looming Coffin Butte Landfill Expansion, Yeager outlines the enormous impact our county attorney, Vance Crony, had on shaping the 2020 landfill franchise agreement in what appears to be the interest of Republic Services, the landfill operator and Fortune 500 company, not the residents of Benton County who pay his handsome salary with our property taxes. Yeager begins by telling us what we can expect from Benton County. Since this article was posted, Benton County has announced that Republic Services has filed the request for a conditional use permit for Coffin Butte Landfill expansion. Yeager begins, Benton County and their partners at Republic Services have announced that the landfill expansion conditional use permit application will be filed soon with the county. Benton County Code defines conditional uses as uses which may have an adverse effect on surrounding permitted uses. The code requires the issuance of a conditional use permit in those circumstances. In land use proceedings, the county is supposed to act as an independent evaluator of material submitted by the developer to support a conditional use permit application. The county is not acting as an unbiased reviewer of the proposal to expand Coffin Butte Landfill. In fall of 2020, Benton County, through its county attorney, Vance Croney, began negotiating the renewal of a 20-year franchise agreement with Republic Services, aka Valley Landfills, to operate the Coffin Butte Landfill. By December 2020, when the county attorney presented the staff report to the Board of Commissioners, it was clear that the county had agreed to work with Republic Services to ensure that an expansion of the landfill would be approved in order to get more money for the county. Yeager continues in outlining the county's incentive to approve landfill expansion. There is a $1 million annual landfill expansion incentive clause built into the franchise agreement, Section 4C, that goes into effect if the landfill expansion is approved by 2024. In addition, as a further incentive to Republic Services, the county agreed to remove the 1.1 million tons of garbage annual limit once the expansion is approved. Quoting from the December 15, 2020 verbal staff report to the Board of Commissioners, Attorney Crony stated, Republic repeatedly informed us that its ability to pay higher fees was dependent upon one of two factors, either reducing costs or increasing capacity. We all agreed that it's far, far more likely that increasing capacity would be the route most viable for Republic Services, and that will take the form of it seeking various governmental approvals to expand its landfill footprint beyond the current cells. Crony goes on to state, as you know, Republic has a lot of property to the south of Coffin Butte Road and further to the west. The property that's south of Coffin Butte Road is currently zoned landfill site, so it's ready to receive, I guess, to begin consideration for use as a cell. Within our development code, however, that particular zone designation requires a conditional use permit. Further, Crony states, that is the area that we anticipate that Republic will seek to gain approval both from DEQ and from Benton County to expand its landfill activities. Once that footprint expands, Republic is confident that it will be able to absorb a higher franchise fee because it will have greater capacity within which to accept waste. Marge speaking. Here I want to interject the fact that Republic Services is an immensely profitable corporation. Republic Services reported a revenue of nearly $15 billion for the year ended December 31, 2023. The Phoenix-based company returned $900 million to shareholders and authorized a $3 billion share repurchase authorization for 2024. Landfills are the most profitable sector for waste management companies such as Republic Services. Republic Services employees have been heard to say that Coffin Butte Landfill is a particularly profitable landfill. Does it really sound to you like they would have difficulty absorbing a higher franchise fee? Yeager goes on to say, later in the verbal report to the commissioners, Crony says, Section 5B as in boy is the tonnage cap. This is the agreement with Republic that the tonnage into the landfill in its current configuration would be capped at 1.1 million tons per year. Once landfill expansion has been approved, that cap goes away. This goes directly to Benton County's strong interest in crafting a mechanism to ensure that the lifespan of the landfill is protected. This does that. It pretty much, and I don't want to say it's a spur, but it is an incentive for Republic to move sooner rather than later on seeking landfill expansion approval. Yeager again. It is not clear to me how removing the tonnage cap and allowing Republic to bring in as much garbage as possible helps to protect the lifespan of the landfill. That is, unless the county and Republic see this expansion request as just the first of many more to come. The county commissioners unanimously approved the 2020 landfill franchise agreement. In summary, Yeager states, it is clear from the staff report compiled during the review of the 2020 franchise agreement that county staff is not going to serve in the role of unbiased reviewer of the impacts and liabilities associated with hosting and expanding Coffin Butte Landfill. In the recently published Solid Waste in Benton County FAQ document, the county states, decisions to approve or deny land use permits at the landfill are not revenue-based decisions. It doesn't look that way to me, says Yeager. It appears to be all about the money. In Bob Dylan's Subterranean Homesick Blues, he sings, "You don't need to be a weatherman to know which way the wind blows, especially if you live within a 10-mile radius of this dump." To find out more about the situation with expanding the Coffin Butte landfill located 9 miles north of Corvallis on Highway 99, just north of Adair Village, visit the website sponsored by the Valley Neighbors for Environmental Quality and Safety, i.e. VNEX, V-N-E-Q-S. Go to coffinbuttefacts.org. That's coffinbuttefacts.org. This is March Pop reading and supporting a statement by Mark Yeager for Community Voices on KORC.
The Corvallis commemoration of the United States atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan, is taking place on Thursday, August 8th at 6:30 p.m. at Riverfront Park, located at Madison and First Streets in downtown Corvallis. The event will feature traditional Japanese koto music, Corvallis Mayor Charles Mon, and other speakers. The event then culminates with the Willamette River Peace Flotilla and Candlelight Vigil. This will take place on Thursday, August 8th at 6:30 p.m. The event is free for all to attend. For more information, visit the Veterans for Peace website at vfpcorvallis.wordpress.com. You may also find them on Facebook at VFP Corvallis, Oregon. This event is sponsored by the Linus Pauling Chapter of Veterans for Peace.
Hey, this is Phil Farrell with KORC, and I'm here with...
My name's Yuli Martinez.
And the reason I'm here today interviewing her is because a couple weeks ago, I was fortunate enough to be part of a quinceañera that she threw for her kids, so figure might as well interview her and get some more information about this event. So, quinceañera, what is the actual definition of quinceañera in English?
Okay, so in the Latino community, when a young girl comes of age is when she is turning 15. That means that she is basically going through the passage of becoming a young woman from being a little girl. It's something that's very traditional in the Latino culture, specifically in Mexico and Southern American countries. And it has become more and more popular here in the U.S. because the Latino community is growing. So yes, that is the definition.
So quinceañera traditionally is for women, as I understand, but in this case you have twins, one boy and one girl. So he was included. And is this common at all?
In the past, it has been traditionally just for women. However, in the last few years, it has evolved and is now more inclusive towards boys. Here, specifically in our community, there has been a few celebrations for young boys here in the last couple of years. And because I have a boy and a girl, I decided to definitely include my son. And the word quinceañera is specific for female, but I decided to change it to a 15 años because that's inclusive to a boy and a girl, and it's just basically saying, you know, your 15th birthday.
Okay, great. And then I was also honored enough to be a padrino, so could you explain what that is?
Yes, part of the celebration of the 15 años is to have padrinos. This is also very traditional from many, many years ago, where you have sponsors. So it's people, friends and family that you feel are close to you, and you ask them to take part in this event. And they are essentially sponsors. So they contribute financially or by providing certain things. So for example, you could have a padrino for, you know, like some of the traditional things that come along with that is like a ring and a necklace that signify the importance of the 15 años, the quinceañera party. And so you can have sponsors for the specific things, or you can have sponsors for just anything in general, right? So like the cake or any other expenses that might be part of the party, these padrinos volunteer and contribute what they can to make this party possible. Again, it's usually family members or close friends that you feel comfortable with, and they, in return, are honored during this party. There's little events that we do here and there at the party to honor these people who have helped throw this party for this young girl or young man.
And I helped out with the DJ mix for the dance, and that was fun. Had the whole choreographers, and we all kind of helped out. And so I helped out with the music, so that was cool. I hope the dance went well. I think it went well. And yeah, you want to talk about the dance maybe?
Yeah, so part of the celebration is for these young adults to have their friends involved in the celebration. So they have what they call damas and chambelanes, and it's a court basically. So they have their little girlfriends and boyfriends, and together they start practicing a performance months before the event. And it's a traditional waltz type of thing that they do to basically start the get the celebration going the day of, but they work really hard a few months beforehand to get this performance. It's a huge presentation that happens, and then they have like surprise dances. So if the kids are into a certain type of music, like banda or cumbia or merengue, then they'll have an additional little dance that goes into it. So that's what Philip is talking about. It's just these young kids that have been practicing for months, and together they put on a show for everybody. And a lot goes behind that, right? Because we have to have a choreographer. We have someone who helps with the music and just helping put on that show that day. Along with the performances from the damas and chambelanes, there's also like a dance with the father or a dance with the mother. There's also other significant things such as the handing of the last doll for the girl or the last toy for the boy. Also there's a, it's called a zapatillas, but typically, I mean, what that really means is the kids grow out of their normal shoes and then step into like adult shoes, right? So the shoes get changed into like boots or heels if it's a girl. And that's kind of signifying that you're stepping out of that and you're kind of going into the next stage of your life. There's also a coronation part where the girl and the guy get crowned, which is also part of the celebration. And yeah, those are some of the little details that go into that.
All right, great. So to start the celebration at the beginning of the day, we had a church ceremony. So you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so the religious part of it goes just back to many years ago when the quinceañera celebration started. It has a religious aspect to it. So there is a celebration that takes place at a mass the church that you regularly attend. And it's a mass dedicated to the quinceañera or the kids that are turning quince años. The priest will go out there and basically the mass is centered around them and how they are now growing from kids to young adults. So that is the religious aspect of it. And he also introduces them, you know, as young adults at the end of the ceremony. And it's a part that has been carried on through tradition for a very long time.
Okay, great. Yeah, it was definitely a big celebration. Went from noon to midnight the first day, and then there was a second day follow-up. Had dances, there was a horse, cake, drinks, music. Do you know the name of the band that performed?
Yes, so we had three bands actually. So Philip is right, it started at noon with the church, and then after that we had pictures, and then it goes to the reception, food, dance time at the venue. And during the day of the main event, there was a mariachi that started here, and they came down from Salem. Then after that there was a tamborazo, which is basically like a band, but there's no one singing, it's just instruments. In Spanish they say instrumentos de viento, which is just instruments, like wind instruments. I don't know if that makes sense, but they don't sing, it's just the playing of the instruments. And they came down from Salem as well. And then in the evening we finished off with a band, and that's Banda Estrella de Oro, and they are from Portland. And then the following day, because there's always like a get together the next day, which is usually just for the more of the immediate family and the opening of the gifts and just kind of as a end to the celebration, maybe a little bit of cleanup. They are a local band that they're named Clase Fina, and it's actually a group of three or four high school students. The main one who plays the accordion and sings is a junior at Willamette High School, and he was also part of the court the day before.
Yeah, I meant to kind of talk to him, but I just didn't have the chance. It just kind of went. But yeah, on an unrelated note, you told me you did some radio back in the day.
Yes, back in the day, I did help out the radio station at the U of O. Back when there was no other Spanish station in the area, the U of O would basically allow members from the community to come in and host a radio show for, I believe it was like 4 hours on Sundays. And I just ended up getting involved, and I was out there playing music, taking calls from the community. You would call in and request songs, and it was something that I really enjoyed doing for a few years.
Sweet. Well, if you ever want to do a show, even just a one-time special here on KORC, you're welcome. And is there anything you want to say to the Spanish-speaking listeners out there?
Yes. Hola. Espero que sigan escuchando aquí a mi amigo Philip. Y ojalá que algún día tenga la oportunidad de hablar en español y ponerles una música en español aquí. Y que tengan un buen día.
Sweet. You want to say your name one more time?
Yeah, my name is Yuli Martinez. Están escuchando 105.9 KORC aquí en el show de Philip. Espero y sigan escuchando.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics, a program heard Sundays from 1 to 2 p.m., repeated on Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m., and archived at our website, korcfm.com. The OSU Research Forests plan to spray McDonald Dunn harvest units as early as this upcoming Thursday, August 1st. The exact dates are dependent on weather conditions and contractor availability. They will spray all treatment units on the McDonald and Dunn forests using ground equipment. The spray effort is going to target vegetation only, not road or trail surfaces. During the application, staff will be at roads and official trails leading into spray areas to keep people away. There will be signs posted at entry points to each treatment area, and the information will include the date of the herbicide application, the type of herbicide that was used, and public re-entry information. The signs will remain in place for 1 week. According to OSU Research Forests, herbicides are used in the research forest to control the growth of non-native plant species and competing vegetation in recently harvested areas. All herbicide applications are conducted in compliance with state and federal regulations and under a licensed pesticide applicator's supervision. There's more information at cf.forestry.oregonstate.edu/FAQ. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. We are here every week from 1 to 2 on Sunday afternoons. You can hear the program repeated 5 to 6 p.m. on Mondays. We archive this program at korcfm.com. And if you are interested in helping tell the local news with KORC, send us an email, info@korcfm.com.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. What you're about to hear is a news update on the Green Peter Dam drawdown at Foster Lake in Sweet Home. It's narrated by filmmaker Brian Hutchings, who is from California and who has been nominated for Academy Awards for 5 films he has produced. This update, entitled Green Peter Drawdown, is produced by Brian, who has narrated, interviewed individuals in the community of Sweet Home, and filmed this piece, which you can find by searching for Green Peter Drawdown on YouTube. This is an audio version or radio edit of this film. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, or ODFW, determined that salmon have died from barotrauma, a condition caused by a rapid pressure reduction as fish pass from deep below the surface on one side of the dam to the other side near the surface level. Divers call this decompression effect the bends. Kokanee salmon, which are not endangered, are particularly sensitive to the pressure change. According to Greg Taylor, a supervisory fish biologist with the Portland District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, we typically see dead kokanee every year when the Corps draws reservoir levels down in the fall. However, we're seeing greater kokanee losses this past year due to operational changes required by a court injunction. At this time of year, fish would historically pass through the dam using a higher elevation outlet called a penstock, but a 2021 court injunction outlined operations for moving fish through a lower elevation regulating outlet this fall. The goal of this change was to improve passage through the dams for Endangered Species Act listed juvenile spring chinook and steelhead salmon. Salmon are surface-oriented fish, so we're hoping they'll key into the increased surface outflows from the reservoir during the drawdown and swim downstream where they need to go, said Catherine Tackley, who is a physical scientist at the Portland District, who is working to implement the injunction measures. Officials at ODFW confirmed at least 8,000 dead kokanee, which are landlocked sockeye salmon that never leave freshwater and spawn in the tributaries of their home lake. The kokanee are not native to the Green Peter Reservoir. Per the court order, Green Peter Reservoir is gradually being drawn down to 780 feet, where it will be held at that elevation from mid-November through mid-December. As the reservoir is drawn lower, the difference in pressure the fish experience when passing through the dam is reduced, which will reduce the barotrauma. Neither the fish die-off nor the reservoir drawdowns are supposed to impact the water quality for purposes such as municipal water supply. However, because of a phenomenon called turbidity, the quality of the water was reduced by making it more opaque or cloudy. Turbidity is a measure of the level of particles such as sediment, plankton, or organic byproducts in a body of water. In this case, the turbidity is caused by silt or sediment. As the turbidity of water increases, it becomes denser and less clear due to a higher concentration of these light-blocking particles. In the film, this phenomenon will be explained more fully, as well as the impact on the economy and quality of life in Sweet Home.
Yeah, buddy. Not a bad place to live.
Green Peter Reservoir. One of Oregon's amazing recreational areas. Secluded, quiet, crystal clear waters. Until. Stemming from a lawsuit, a court ruled that the Army Corps of Engineers, who manages the dams, was in violation of the Endangered Species Act. U.S. District Judge Marco Hernandez issued an injunction in September of 2021, requiring the Corps to start deep drawdowns of four reservoirs, including Green Peter, which was to have the deepest of drawdowns. In June 2023, the drawdowns began. In August, Green Peter's drawdown started in earnest. Kokanee are a landlocked sockeye salmon that never leave the fresh water and spawn in the rivers and streams of their home lake. The drawdown, which was to benefit the Chinook salmon, had the opposite effect on the Kokanee salmon. Estimates are 8 to 10,000 Kokanee salmon died due to barotrauma, a condition that is caused by rapid pressure reduction when fish pass deep on one side of the dam and come out at the surface on the other side. The effect is similar to divers experiencing the bends if they come up too fast.
I didn't understand nor learn of the full impact it would truly have on our community until October 6th, when I started to receive text messages and images of thousands of dead fish that were coming from the Green Peter Dam and Reservoir.
What also became apparent was what the drawdown was doing to water quality. Large quantities of silt had been loosened in the process and was left clouding the water downstream.
I first learned about the drawdown in February of 2023 when the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers came to Sweet Home and held a public meeting where they outlined the plans that they had in light of the injunction that was put on them at the federal court level. There, they presented models of what they anticipated would happen.
So there's different aspects of the drawdown that was modeled, right? We modeled the fish passage aspects of it. We modeled, but the one that most folks are interested in hearing about is the water quality pieces of it. And it was really modeled in two ways. It was the turbidity was modeled. It's, you know, what is so visual and everybody, you know, sees and is upset about. But also the temperature was modeled. And both of those, you know, I would say were things that we knew were going to have some impact.
The impact was far-reaching. Not far below Green Peter Reservoir is Foster Reservoir. Foster serves as the water supply for the city of Sweet Home. Residents found their usual crystal clear water now cloudy. Sweet Home Water Treatment Facility brought a third filter online and added additional chlorine to help offset the changes in water quality. Due to the amount of silt still in water, residents noted that the quality was not overly improved.
Good evening, everybody. We're really glad you are here. I know that we're not here on good terms right now, or for good, like...
We're not here for a stupid school, freaking...
Further downstream, the city of Lebanon and also Albany had to compensate for the changes in water quality. Estimates are as high as $7 million will need to be spent by the three cities to correct the water quality. The impact to the fish of Green Peter and Foster reservoirs is, let's say, unclear.
The potential impact of turbidity on fish depends upon the level of the turbidity, how long it lasts, the size and particles of the turbidity, the life stage of the fish being affected, and the temperature. For example, a fish has more trouble bringing oxygen into its body when there are high levels of turbidity. So that stresses the fish out, and it can cause disease. Temperature, if temperatures are higher, that can also impact fish, particularly salmonids. Also, in terms of feeding, when turbidity is high, fish are not as easily able to find food, and so they frequently lose weight. And they can also be more susceptible to predation because they cannot see predators. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife will conduct a survey below Foster Dam this year looking for Young of the Year Chinook, which means we are looking for fish that have hatched out of eggs this spring. If we find good numbers of those young of the year, we will likely be able to conclude that there was good production and that a number of reds were not smothered by the turbidity or by settlement settling out from the turbidity. We will also be looking for evidence of that sediment on the river bottom as we do the survey.
With Green Peter drained, boat launches and campgrounds were closed. They are expected to remain closed for almost 7 months. The impact to local businesses is significant. Fishermen, boaters, and campers looking to grab last-minute supplies before heading up to Green Peter and Foster are now not coming.
And for us, you know, our business has been, there's been a drastic drop, 25 to 30% drop in calls coming in, and in boat sales is down about 70%, which has been always been a big part of what we do is boat sales. And as of now, this is March 2024, and we've sold one boat this year. You know, I have 15 boats on the lot, and I've sold one all year. So, has it affected us? Greatly.
Our dream was to find a home with a view, and we knew Sweet Home was a beautiful area. We had been here before, and we got kind of tired of staring at the back of our neighbor's house for 20 years and looking for something like this, which when we saw the house, we fell in love with it. And we love the community, just enjoy it every time since we moved here, until we noticed our beautiful lake is transformed into something that looks like chocolate milk. What's really frustrating is this is affecting our view, it's affecting our property values, it's affecting our drinking water, it's affecting our recreation, it's affecting business in town.
I'm Milton Moran. I am the president of Cascade Timber Consulting, have been since January 1st, 2018, and I've never seen a sustained for 7+ weeks now of this heavy turbidity. Never seen this. A prudent person saw the mud that was coming out of this when it got to that point where it was super muddy. Why didn't someone say, let's hold off a minute? What's it going to hurt? Shut it off, take a look, you know, do some analysis and say, this is going to be terribly dirty for the river. And I thought, well, what are we talking? A couple weeks? Here it has been 7+ weeks now, and we're still seeing this turbidity at great levels. If we did this as an industry, we would be in big trouble, big trouble.
A key point in this whole thing to understand is that once we had that action identified in the judge's final order, the final order is not discretionary. And so really, you know, the bar for us to have either stopped something or done something different, we would have had to identify it like a life safety issue.
Maybe the drawdown wasn't life-threatening, but the impact to the surrounding communities and the ecosystem was immense. Is the ecosystem expected to repair itself by the time the next drawdown occurs again in the later half of 2024? Did it really achieve its goal? But at what cost? What is the best outcome?
The best outcome for the city of Sweet Home would be to not have this drawdown happen again. Currently, the plans are that the drawdown would occur annually, and we would anticipate that we would encounter some of the same issues that we've encountered this year. So not having the drawdown happen again is the best outcome for us. We would also like to see solutions that would actually help the salmon, other solutions besides a drawdown. There are other options that we know of. We just know they cost the federal government money, and so far there hasn't been any money allocated for those options. We would like to see the federal government choose to put money towards options that do not impact our drinking water and other wildlife.
In December, the Army Corps of Engineers came under scrutiny as the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality sent the Army Corps a notice that the Corps had violated the state's water quality standards due to the increased turbidity. In February, the governor of Oregon sent a letter to the communities affected saying, "What happened to your communities is unacceptable. I assure you that my team and I are closely tracking this discussion. The Corps has proposed over $1 billion in recovery measures that have considerable uncertainty being realized. Our agencies are advocating that the lower cost solutions to address diminishing fish runs covered by the federal ESA be examined and that any cost to the communities be factored into the federal budget."
I mean, I'm a public servant. And the reality is, I don't like people being impacted. I mean, that's the last thing I want in my role. Last thing I want. And so it's just painful.
Although the state of Oregon was not pleased with the way the drawdown of Green Peter was handled, nonetheless, the state so far has been unwilling to compensate the impacted cities for the extra millions that had to be averted to water treatment.
I don't know if the damage done by all this silt loading in the river, is it irreparable? Is it ever going to be okay? Is it going to be fine gravels here again? There probably will be eventually, but in the meantime, there's been an awful lot of damage, I think, to the ecosystem in the South Santa Ana River. You know, they say that fish need invertebrates to live on, and they're really concerned. People I've heard quite concerned that the invertebrates that are in the river that feed the fish aren't surviving this heavy siltation.
Some of the guys with sonar have come by, some of the guys with the $90,000-$100,000 boats, and they're not seeing any coconut running sonar. And they have the most high-tech advanced stuff that you can get. And one gentleman who I trust greatly said he saw 3 fish, and they were up there about 4 hours, and they were bass. and that was the only three fish they saw the whole time.
Due to heavier than expected rains, Green Peter Reservoir is ahead of schedule for refilling. On the surface, the lake looks normal. Will the boaters and campers return? Probably. Can the ecosystem recover by the next drawdown? Probably not.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, heard Sundays from 1 to 2 p.m. and Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. and archived online at korcfm.com. This coming Thursday, August 1st, at 4:30 p.m., Johnson Collections Center, which is located at 1063 Main Street in Philomath, there is a solar project which is a collaboration of the Benton County Historical Society, the Corvallis Sustainability Coalition, and the Oregon Clean Power Cooperative. Funding from Pacific Power's Blue Sky Program participants, Energy Trust of Oregon, and community investors and donors enabled the installation of 110 kilowatts of solar panels on the roof of the Johnson Collections Center, where the Historical Society stores artifacts that are not on display at its museums. The energy produced by the panels is now providing most of the electricity needed for both the collection center and the Philomath Museum. The ribbon cutting this coming Thursday, 4:30 p.m., August 1st, is open to the public. You can find out more information by emailing info@sustainablecorvallis.org. On Monday night, July 29th, there is a Monday night acoustic jam from 6 to 7:30 p.m. in Albany at the taproom of the Deluxe Brewing Company. Their address is 635 Northeast Water Avenue. It's an open invite, acoustic-only jam, open to all ages and experience levels for acoustic musicians. The group lead, Sharon Carter, will be on site starting at 5 p.m. If you're listening on Sunday, that's tomorrow at 5. If you're listening to the Monday edition, well, it's already started. Attendees are welcome to arrive to begin practice. Sign up for all player jam songs starts at 5:30 p.m. This is at Deluxe Brewing in Albany, their address 635 Northeast Water Avenue. This is KORC.
You're listening to KORC. I'm Nick Martin. The following is an article titled Eastern Oregon Fire is Nation's Largest Active Wildfire, written by the Associated Press. Powerful winds and hundreds of lightning strikes from thunderstorms rattled eastern Oregon and Idaho Wednesday afternoon, cutting power and stoking fires, including one in Oregon that is already the largest active blaze in the nation. The Durkee Fire, burning near the Oregon-Idaho border, caused the closure of a stretch of Interstate 84 again Wednesday. Amid rapidly forming storms in the afternoon, the blaze crossed the interstate near the town of Huntington, home to about 500 people. It also merged with the Cow Valley Fire that had been burning nearby, Governor Tina Kotek said. The lightning-sparked fire started July 17th, about 5 miles southwest of Durkee in Baker County, and has grown to 268,492 acres. It is 0% contained. The wildfires in eastern Oregon have scaled up quickly, Kotek said in a news release, calling it a dynamic situation. We are facing strong erratic winds over the region that could impact all fires. Rain is not getting through. Some communities do not have power, she said. She said she had deployed the National Guard to the region. Officials had been concerned that lightning from the storm could spark new blazes. More than 2,800 cloud-to-ground lightning strikes were detected across southeast Oregon and Idaho on Wednesday alone, the National Weather Service in Boise said Thursday. The wildfire had prompted the evacuation of Huntington on Sunday, and on Wednesday, city officials posted on Facebook that people remaining in town, especially those with, quote, major health issues, needed to leave their homes because of wildfire smoke and the lack of power. City officials also said Wednesday that gas service to residents had been shut off until the evacuation orders could be lifted. Wind, lightning, and heavy rain remain ongoing dangers and could cause flash flooding and debris flows in recently burned areas, authorities said. Flash flood warnings were issued for Huntington and in a nearby burn scar area. The Oregon State Fire Marshal's office mobilized nearly 500 firefighters to help protect communities that could be threatened by wildfires. More than 60 significant fires are burning in Oregon and Washington alone, and Oregon has been plagued with hundreds of lightning strikes from thunderstorms in recent days that have started new fires and bone-dry vegetation. The smoke from the Durkee fire was choking the air, with an air quality warning in effect for the entire region on Wednesday. That was the article titled, "Eastern Oregon Fire is Nation's Largest Active Wildfire," written by the Associated Press. You're listening to KORC.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Serra. On Tuesday, July 29th at 11 a.m., the Climate Action Advisory Board Workgroup Utility Decarbonization will be meeting virtually at 11 a.m. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the meeting. Also on Tuesday, July 29th, but at 4 p.m., the Economic Development Coalition meeting will be virtual and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. For details on how to join the meeting virtually, see CorvallisOregon.gov. And finally, on Saturday, August 3rd, Ward 5 Councilor Charlene Ellis will hold Government Comment Corner in the lobby of the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. You can stop by to say hello and ask your questions about your local government. Located at the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library here in Corvallis, 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Serra.
So this is Phil Farrell on KORC. And I went to the Asian celebration in Eugene. This took place Saturday, July 28th at the Alton Baker Park in Eugene. And when I was there, they were doing different cultural dances from different countries. So I interviewed a couple of the dancers to describe their dances, what countries they come from. So I'm going to let them talk to you. So I'm here with, what's your name?
Katie Adele.
And describe the dance you did today.
Well, the dance I did comes from the southern region of Iran. So it's from the Gulf area, and it has an influence from the Arabic countries and North Africa. Some of the music will use djembe, which is an African instrument, not a Persian instrument. There's bandari means of the port. So there's a lot of hand, like waving of the hands in the dance, mm-hmm. which is mimicking the how the fishermen communicate with each other on the dock.
All right, thank you. Is there anything you want to say? Are you the coordinator?
Yeah, I was the organizer of this event, and we just wanted to bring authentic dances from Asia Minor, or that strip between Turkey and Iran. And that's why we wanted to focus on how our dancing applies to Asia. So we picked dances from Turkey to Iran. I performed a traditional Turkish Roman or Turkey Roma dance, which is has an odd rhythm. It's a 9-8, very energetic. And then our folk, I danced with the local community folk dancers. They're called Vesulu dancers. And we performed the Turkish spoon dance. And the second dance was a Lebanese depke, Ceyteli. And the depke is an example of a living dance, which is a community dance. It's performed at like a wedding or a gathering or perform. You know, it's not for performing. It's more for bringing everybody in the community together. As you saw, we have children, mm-hmm. old people, very easy steps, yeah. An organic traditional rhythm, and everybody dances. Mm-hmm. And that's the living dance tradition. It's very alive and well in Eastern Europe and in Turkey and all over Anatolia, and some of the Middle East, like Lebanon. So depke is just the name of the dance. It's all over the Midwest, the Middle East.
Okay, great.
So yeah, and we have performances. We, you know, there's live music sometimes. We Yeah, so.
Okay.
Anything else you wanted to know? Or?
No? Are you from around here?
No, I'm from Bulgaria. I'm originally from Bulgaria. Okay. And I grew up with living dances. And that's why I think it's so important to have, to kind of even expose people to this. Because I feel like here we have like a country dance or the, you know, the cross dance, whatever that's called. But it's not the same, you know, doesn't really reach everybody. Mm-hmm. And the dances over there, they reach everybody. They're for everybody. It's a living dance that everybody can participate in. And it really brings together people.
Okay.
And it just reminded me of, there was a, after the Battle of Wounded Knee, there was this concept of this deity, it's called Wovoka. And it's a Native American deity that said, people must dance and must sing if we were to survive.
Yeah.
So it's like a really important to bring that vibration from everybody together.
And are you part of like a group that people can contact, or is this like a dance group, or are you just kind of?
I'm a soloist, but we do the folk dancing. Yes, we have a group. We meet every Sunday at 7:15 at the Athletic Club on Lament and 24th. And we have hundreds of dances there, like hundreds.
Okay.
The belly dancing is more separate. You know, there's lots of different groups and not very many teachers, though. So it's, we need more teachers around here. So.
Okay, I'll have to check it out one day.
Yeah.
And then what is your name again?
My name is Deanna Smith.
Deanna Smith. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll stay in touch and...